Hello and welcome to Talking Therapies, a podcast made together with Psychology's Magazine and the UK Council for Psychotherapy, or UKCP for short. I'm Susie Walker and I'm the Editor-in-Chief at Psychology's. Each month on Talking Therapies, we will be talking to a UKCP therapist about a range of topics. In this episode, we will be discussing finding love in the 21st century.
What is happening when users go online to use online dating is they are being asked to reduce themselves down to the value of how photogenic they are.
That was UKCP psychotherapist Denise Dunn. Recently, Denise featured in BBC Like Mind series, which looked at the dating apps and their effect on our mental health. Denise has extensive experience within the mental health sector, working within the NHS, a leading mental health charity, and now fully in private practice. While Denise's main clinical expertise lies in treating complex mental health conditions, in particular borderline personality disorder, with an earlier career in the tech sector and Silicon Valley, she also has an interest in how our use of technology affects our relationships and mental health. Denise is also an active board member of the International Attachment Network. Shortly, Denise will be talking to Sarah Niblock, CEO of the UK Council for Psychotherapy, to find out why so many of us have turned to apps to find love. But first, here are some comments about dating apps from people we spoke to on the street.
I have used many a dating app, Tinder, Bumble, Happn, done it all really.
I think people can find love on a dating app. I think you both have to be wanting to find love for it to work.
You can find love anywhere, so why is it no different on a dating app?
So I don't use dating apps anymore, but when I did, I think it was kind of, so the ease in that you could literally just, you know, you had 5 minutes on a bus, on a train, on a whatever, waiting for your friends, you could just scroll through and meet people through that. It's easier to find people in common, I think, because obviously you can put in your interests or whatever and then they can match you with stuff like that. And also, it's like the shallow aspect of you don't have to accept anyone you're not actually attracted to, so I think that's quite useful. It kind of like cuts out the blind dating side of dating.
Personally, I don't think people can find love on a dating site app. I really feel you've got to meet a person and get to know them. Mind you, being the age I am, that's what we did in our day. You get to know somebody first.
I think dating apps can impact on someone's mental health because there's that whole aspect of ghosting someone. So you could be talking to someone for weeks, days, months, however long it is, and then they ignore you. It can really damage how you see yourself, and I guess it's a lot easier to ghost someone if you've not met them, and if you're on the receiving end of that, it can be really detrimental to your health.
My advice would be to, if you're looking for love online, to always make sure that you keep yourself safe. If you are going to go and meet someone you don't know, tell a friend or a family member that you're going or where you're going, and if you know the name of the person, their name, and when you come back, make sure you tell them that you're back again.
Research into dating apps found that the app exposed users to a considerable amount of rejection. 50% said the matches did not message back. These negative experiences can dramatically affect self-confidence. A study by the University of North Texas revealed that male Tinder users were less satisfied with their appearance and had lower levels of self-worth than those not on the app. With many now feeling disposable as a result of dating apps, how can we utilise these online platforms in a more positive way?
So Denise, why are more and more of us turning to dating apps to find love?
Well, I think it's a combination of reasons, really. First of all, there is obviously the fundamental need that human beings have to be in a meaningful relationship. And I think the environment in which we're looking for it, the offline environment in which we're looking for it, is no longer really as viable as it used to be. And now we have a technology that comes along that sort of addresses those needs. So what I mean by that is, as an attachment-based psychotherapist, obviously I understand people to be motivated by the need for intimate relationships. And if you think about how we used to build those relationships, we used to rely on our circle of friends, our social circle, and the workplace. But if you look at the current environment for young people and single people, basically at the moment, what we're seeing is people have less disposable income, they have less free time, we're working harder than ever. We're working away from our homes, so we're more mobile than ever. So our social circles have actually become much smaller. We're working away from our workplace, most of us, because rents and mortgages are so high that we have to commute long distances outside of the city. So we have less time, money and opportunity to meet people. And if we think about the workplace, at the moment the workplace is not really a very safe place to approach people for romantic relationships. So if we think about the technology that we have, so the main apps in this country would be, for the gay community, would be Grindr, and for the heterosexual community would be Tinder. If we look at both of these, they're both free. They're both always available. So they're on our mobile phones, they're in our pockets whenever we need them. And they're full of consenting available adults. So it perfectly fits that gap that has opened up in our environment. But I think it's worth noting that sort of marrying technology with matchmaking is not actually a new thing. It's been around for about as long as modern technology has been around. In fact, the first go at a dating app was in 1959 in Stanford University. Two young students there created a program to try and match 49 men with 49 women. It's called, I think it's called Happy Family, so no pressure about the outcomes there. But I think what that exemplifies is that for as long as we've had a command of technology, we've tried to use it in a way to make finding a match much more easy, much less painful, disappointing experience with less rejection. And I think actually that is also a big success factor behind the use of these apps, because they allow us to, in some ways, hide or mitigate from that rejection.
Well, that's really interesting what you say about the sort of hiding or mitigating, because in previous podcasts we've looked at, you know, this huge industry that's grown around our physicality and our appearance, but long gone, it would seem, are the days when you got dressed up and went out to find a future partner. Now, presenting ourselves online, I'm interested to know whether dating apps have actually changed the way we present ourselves to potential partners and what effect that might have on us.
Gosh, I mean, absolutely, absolutely. And I think this particular area has some of the best aspects of online dating and some of the very worst. But I think in terms of the best, I think often when we talk about online dating from a psychological perspective, we tend to focus on the problems. And obviously for today's podcast, we're probably going to do a lot of that too, because that's where a psychotherapist comes in handy. But it is important to say that online dating in itself is not a bad thing. It's actually very successful. I think the current statistics statistics are probably already out of date. I think one in three new marriages starts online, the relationship starts online. I think something like 70 or 80% of gay relationships begin online. So it's actually quite a positive story. It can create good relationships, and anything that connects people in a positive way from a psychotherapeutic and a mental health perspective is a good thing. I think the problem with online dating from a psychological perspective is more around the design of the current apps and how certain aspects of the design interacts with our psychology in a problematic way.
That's interesting.
But just back to how it changes how we present ourselves to each other. From a positive perspective, as I mentioned before, when we used to meet our matches offline, we were sort of limited in terms of the scope of people that we could meet. So that would be our social circle or typically at work. But there's 57 million people on Tinder. I think it's something like 27 million on Grindr. So it's a far greater number, but there's also, more importantly and more positively, because a greater number isn't actually, as you will see, it's not actually a particularly good thing, but the variety of people that we meet online is actually a really positive story, really positive story. And some research that Tinder did of its own user base revealed that a much higher percentage of Tinder users date outside their ethnicity than people who date offline. And as a result, a much higher percentage of users have tried new activities, make of that what you may, social activities, they've taken up new hobbies, and importantly, they've become politically and socially involved. So this aspect of online dating is actually a really positive story for mental health. Anything that integrates us within a community and broadens our community while differentiating ourselves at the same time is actually very, very, very beneficial for mental health. So that's actually a really good aspect and a very different way in how we're presented to people. A far less positive story, I'm afraid to say, is the other way in which it changes how we present to each other, and that's the reduced criteria on which we're able to determine whether someone is or is not attractive to us. So if you think about the apps that we use, they do have some text, of course, but they are predominantly picture-based.
Mm.
And what we're seeing from our clinical work, and it's being played out right universally, almost universally in research, is that this is a really difficult, very thorny, problematic area, much bigger than you might think. So what sort of aspects, what sort of things do you look for in a person that would determine their attractiveness? Just off the top of your head.
Oh, like animals.
They like animals, yeah. Me too. Yep.
Shared interests. Definitely values. I think
values.
I'd be looking for people who shared the same values
same
as
values.
Me. Belief in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It would obviously be characteristics like age or...
Yeah. What about physicality? What sort of things?
Gosh, that's
a
very good question. And I should say for our listeners that I have been married 27 years. I've been married 10 years.
She's not looking
27
off
years,
the market.
Of course I never think about those things. Healthy.
There you
healthy.
Go. Okay, so actually...
Somebody who's going to be around... I mean, I'm older now. Somebody who's going to still be there in 10
older.
Years' time.
Mm. But if you think about it, already you're actually, just out of interest, already you are presenting very much as a typical female on online dating, is that we look not for how people look, we start with their values.
Mm.
But actually, that aside, when we're thinking about what attraction is, we have the concept of perceived attractiveness. So perceived attractiveness, if we're thinking about, so if I'm thinking about a man or a woman who might be attractive, I'm going to be thinking about, yes, how they look, but more how they move, how they laugh, how they eat, their tone of voice, their sense of humour, how they dance, are they interested in sport, how they are with their friends, how they are with their family, what they're like in a crowd, what their interests are they clever, you know, are they doing something they're passionate about. As a psychotherapist, what I would say is also that what attracts us to people is some, we're often not aware of this, but that they have a complementary attitude towards relationships and how they perform in them. So what we know is that actually attractiveness is a huge, multivariant, ineffable thing.
Mm.
And there have been multiple experiments and efforts to try and replicate and predict it, and all of them have failed. So we know that we cannot quantify attraction.
No.
Yeah.
No. I mean, as you're speaking, I'm thinking about, if somebody really slurped their dinner,
yeah.
You go out, you found the George Clooney, he looks like his picture,
eats with his mic
you get open. There and the
mm-hmm.
dinner goes straight
and
down the shirt.
Exactly. So we
can't tell that.
You cannot tell that. But also who we are as attractive people. So not even thinking of the other person as attractive, but perhaps more importantly for what I'm about to talk about, when we think about ourselves, who we are, if I think about my own qualities, they definitely don't begin with how I look, but they're vast, and they're a composite of my experience and how I am with other people. What is happening when users go online to use online dating is they are being asked to reduce themselves down to the value of how photogenic they are. And this is called objective attractiveness, which is completely different to perceived attractiveness and is really incidental in terms of how attractive you are as a person and to other people, so to yourself and to other people. So in the process of creating a profile and in the process of interacting through that profile and with other picture-based profiles, what we're doing is we are absolutely devaluing ourselves, we're invalidating ourselves, and we're presenting in a very false way to ourselves and to other people. And what research has demonstrated, so there's a really good piece of research that's very accessible that listeners might want to access by the University of North Texas. And they asked users of online dating to self-rate their mood having come off. And almost all of them rated a decline in their self-esteem, in their satisfaction with their body type and their appearance, increased feelings of body shame in particular, an increased fixation with what the media describes as beauty, an increased tendency to compare themselves and compare themselves unfavorably with other people. And I mean, that's absolutely a reflection of what we're seeing in our clinical rooms, is that not even are people talking about this more, but what we're seeing is the way they talk about it is actually quite alarming. So we're hearing things like, well, no, I don't want to go out again until I look good in a picture. No, I don't want to go on holiday this year. I don't look good in pictures. Suddenly, the value of who we are is being defined by how we look in a photograph, which is a really, really damaging thing.
Mm.
Not just because it's unattainable, because the media image of how we should look is very mutative. It changes all the time. When I was a teenager, it moved from Cindy Crawford to heroin chic in the space of like 2 years. But even the people on the media are so filtered, they don't look like that either. So people are being put in a position where they're going to find themselves wanting, and they're going to falsely equate being lovable with looking right in a photograph. Mm. And when we're seeing this is really affecting
people.
So how
does that manifest itself in the relationships if they do take off and manage to find someone who's got mutual interest in them? Do dating apps affect the relationship as it progresses?
They do affect the relationship as it progresses. And I think to a small degree to do with how people physically look, because obviously we're going to try and make ourselves look as unattractive as possible in photographs in order to get people to click on us. And obviously we're not going to look like that offline. So there is a slight, I wouldn't say there's a massive amount of disappointment there that I'm hearing, but there is a slight effect there. But I think what we're actually seeing is that it's part of a broader objectification, process of objectification that the apps are encouraging, and that actually affects how we behave in relationships.
You mentioned the term ghosting. That doesn't sound very nice. What is it? And what happens, and how does it potentially harm us?
Oh, ghosting is the media's favourite. I mean, there are lots of ways in which people are mistreating themselves on these apps, but are mistreating themselves and each other on these apps. But I think ghosting is the one that warrants the most attention, because it involves loss. And I think for most of us, we can identify with loss as one of the most painful things that we go through. Mm-hmm. So the end of a relationship is often what will bring someone to psychotherapy, not just the end of a relationship with a person, but with a job or with an idea, etc. Because it generates so many questions for ourselves. And more often than not, if you think about a breakup, whenever you were single, if you think about a breakup that you did have, you know, one of the first things you think is, even when you're the one doing the breaking up, what did I do wrong?
Yeah.
Which can very quickly morph into, what is it about me that's unlovable? Which can very quickly morph into, this never goes right for me, what am I doing wrong? It becomes a very personalised experience.
There must be something just inbuilt that's wrong with me, which is a horrible, horrible,
just a pernicious emotion. Painful. I feel myself smarting as you're saying it. But also, if you think about what I said earlier about this conflation of worth with how we look in a photograph, that's where we get really problematic, because people are going through these relationships that are primed to fail in many cases, ending up saying, as you do, very validly saying, what is it about me? And then they're thinking, oh, I don't look good enough. But what is particularly painful about ghosting is that not only are we left with no answers to those questions, but we're also left with this feeling that whatever it is about me, I'm not even worth an answer. So it's a very, very painful experience for the person going through loss. And having lots of those unanswered questions makes it much more difficult to mourn that loss, to make sense of it, to actually find something valuable in it and move on. But what isn't talked about, and what I can talk about because I'm a psychotherapist and I tend not to sort of vilify people in these situations, is how it affects the person doing the ghosting. Because someone who's doing ghosting is often thought as the perpetrator, therefore the strong one, the one causing the harm. But actually, someone who's ghosting is fearful. They're afraid. Their self-esteem is probably not very strong. They're probably not very emotionally resilient. They're quite vulnerable. They cannot face being a bad person. And they cannot distinguish between behaviour that causes another person to be upset, or behaviour that is intended to make another person upset. And so they're avoiding situations that make them feel emotionally dysregulated. But as any psychologist or psychotherapist will tell you, if you have a fear and you continually avoid confronting that fear, you're going to make that fear worse. Mm-hmm. So these people who are able to hide in the app and avoid confronting someone saying, look, you know, this isn't working out for whatever these reasons, they are missing out on an opportunity to actually become a much stronger, much more resilient person, mm-hmm. and to have better relationships moving forward. So I think the ghosting phenomenon, which is enabled by the sort of objectivity and the hiddenness of the app, I think the ghosting phenomenon affects both sides of the equation, the person being ghosted, but also the person doing it.
Well, that's an important message. Another aspect to these apps, as you were speaking, I was also thinking about an interview we did a little while ago with Richard Nichols, a UK CP psychotherapist, specifically around addiction. And it was very interesting how addiction can affect us in so many different aspects of our lives and can creep up without us necessarily realising it. And just everyday lifestyle things can actually become potentially addictive.
Mm.
And I wondered about these apps. Is there a potential danger here that having gone through perhaps one cycle of ghosting or rejection or possible success, that you might just get slightly hooked on that process in an unhealthy way?
Sort of in, from a social perspective, yeah. Yeah. And we are seeing that, and people quite freely talk about that. Is it not even when they're ghosted, but when something doesn't work out, they're straight back on the app.
Yeah, I thought it was very interesting what you said about people getting straight back on, because if you a relationship broke down offline, you would tend to say, I need a bit of a break now. Need to sort of spend a bit of time on my own. Perhaps it's healthy to spend some time reflecting on where that may have gone wrong, what my role might have been in that, and what I've learned about myself. But if you can just pick up your smartphone, open the app, you could do that 5 minutes after you get that rejection text, couldn't you?
Unfortunately, that's very much the case. And unfortunately, it isn't very obvious to people the damage that they're doing, because they're in doing it, they're avoiding feeling quite painful feelings. But of course, we know as psychotherapists, just because we're not attending to a feeling doesn't mean it's not there and having an effect on us. So the effect of going straight back online is going to be this cumulative loss process, but also this cumulative experience where we move further and further away from who we are as individuals, because we're not making sense of these relationships that we're having and why they're breaking down and how we feel about it and how that can change our behaviour. So people can very much get stuck in that sort of cycle. But there are other aspects of the app as well that sort of fit into this idea of addiction. I don't think it's fair to say that the apps themselves are addictive, because of course many of us use them and we're not addicted. But there is something about the structure of the technology that is very sticky, and that can, in people who are a little bit susceptible, maybe people who don't feel very well about themselves, who don't have very good self-esteem or have quite low mood, that they can actually bring about a sort of compulsive use. So anything that's internet-based that has, or well, anything at all that involves a repetitive action to bring about a certain but unpredictable reward activates our dopamine search and reward system, which is the neurobiological system that underpins addiction, which effectively means that when we're searching for something and we win it, so a match, for example, or a like, we get a nice burst of dopamine, which is very intoxicating, doesn't last very long, and is self-reinforcing. We know how to get it again, and we find ourselves sort of compulsively using the app in order to feel okay. And the narrative might be, oh, I'm just spending time, just killing time. But actually what we're doing is we're generating more and more dopamine from an outside, an exogenous source. And when we do that, what it means is our internal dopamine production, it's not as effective anymore. So we actually do become more and more reliant. Our mood becomes lower when we're not on the apps. Now, if we pair that with the evidence that we have with people who self-rate as having low self-esteem, tend to use the apps much more, it's quite a potent combination.
Mm.
So it is slightly problematic in that regard.
So what you're saying is these apps can, if left unchecked, have a lowering effect on our mood overall, because that chemical effect is self-defeating, and perhaps, I mean, I've heard something about serotonin, the constant flood of dopamine can actually mean that we're not having that everyday feeling of being okay, which serotonin levels can secure. So it may actually be damaging our mental health if we're not conscious of our behaviours around these apps.
It absolutely is, Sarah. You know, and when we're exposed to the apps, it also affects how we feel about ourselves and our bodies.
Mm.
So we have a sort of cognitive structure along with this neurobiological structure that interact together in a quite compelling way.
That's a very, very heady combination.
Mm.
So I wanted to ask you then, I mean, we don't want to say that these are essentially bad things. And as you say, it's not the apps per se. There's a whole accumulation of factors. And there are success stories, as you've heightened. If somebody is thinking about embarking on using these apps to find love, do you have any advice for them to go into that healthily?
I absolutely do. And what I would start with is, do not go onto online dating thinking that it is the online version of offline world. It is completely different, and it has completely different dynamics. So I would say, bear in mind, so if we think about the statistics, if we bear in mind that there are estimated 50 to 57 million people globally on Tinder at the moment. In any week, there are 11.2 billion swipes. But of that 11.2 billion, only 182 matches are made. So that's a success rate, a conversion rate of about 1.6%.
Mm.
And of the 57 million people, only 1 million are on a date in any week.
Mm.
So if you're going on with the idea that, oh my goodness, 57 million people, this is going to be hot stuff, actually, you're probably going to be disappointed. And actually, it's quite interesting because there's a concept there that I don't think very many people are aware of, but it's a very established psychological concept called the choice paradox. Are you aware of it?
No, please okay. Explain that.
It's very interesting because obviously a lot of people go on the apps because they're like, God, there's so many people, I'm definitely going to find someone. But actually what we know from a lot of research is that the more choice we offer someone, the more confused they become about what it is they're looking for, and the higher their standards go, the more difficult it is for them to be satisfied and the more difficult it is for them to commit, which explains a lot from what we're seeing in the offline behaviour. So when you're online and you think, oh my goodness, I'm definitely going to meet someone, be aware that it actually is, it is in many ways more difficult because there are a lot of people online.
Mm-hmm.
So be aware of that. Also be aware that this is one for men. Men go on and rather indiscriminately swipe right. Is it right they swipe for to like someone? I'm pretending I've never used them, but no, I don't think I have. But men, they like, whereas we know that women are much slower to like someone, much more discriminating about it. Men have reported feeling quite bad because they're not seeing as many likes as they're giving out. So men, just be aware that women do it a lot more slowly than men do. The other thing that I would say is, yes, it's very picture-based, but primarily for men. And the second most important thing for men, it's very close to the first, is interests. So women, pay attention to the interests on your profile because it's almost as important as looks.
Mm-hmm.
Men, don't worry too much about the looks because women rank at third. They're more interested in your profile and they're more interested in your interests. So put more effort into that and don't get too hung up on how it is that we look. What else I would say? Okay, so ghosting, when you actually do get on a date, if you find that you're not being treated very well, try not to personalise it too much.
Mm-hmm.
I think we always have to have a good think about, well, what did I have to do with this? But also bear in mind that it is a quite objectifying experience. It's a gamified experience. So try not to make it about yourself. Try not to make it, oh my goodness, what did I do to deserve this treatment? And try and think, just, you know, get through this. It's a sort of a byproduct of the app. If you feel that you are overusing it, or if you just notice that you're using it a lot, but you don't really think you're overusing it, have a look at your usage patterns. So I don't mean how much you use it, but for what purposes. If you're using it just to find someone, super. If you're using it just to pass the time, you may actually be causing yourself quite a lot of damage. And what you might want to do is think, well, why am I using it? Instead of just stopping using it, why am I using it? Am I bored? Am I feeling worried about something? Or do I not like being out in public? And try and find something else that satisfies that need to help come off it.
I hear you, that conscious checking in. So Denise, how do you think psychotherapy can help someone who's searching for a partner, perhaps in any context, whether it's online, digitally, through an app, or bumping into someone in a cafe?
From a psychotherapeutic perspective, we understand that who we are in relationships is often not very clear to us and is something that is set in our infancy. And this is something that psychotherapists are experts in. So what it can help us do is really have a second opinion, basically an objective perspective on what might be happening in relationships. But it can actually really help you clarify to yourself what it is you're looking for. Is it the right thing for you to be looking for? Because we are compelled to repeat. So what we can often find ourselves doing is just repeating the relationships that we've had in the past in the hope that they will improve. And that's where psychotherapy is really useful, because it can really pinpoint quite accurately what those patterns are and help you broaden your perspective a little bit as to how they could be a little bit healthier and what you are doing or what you are attracting from other people that might be creating sort of slightly problematic relationship or relationships that aren't working. And armed with the knowledge of how that is affected in the online world, so this, it is a slightly different environment to the offline world, when the psychotherapist has that perspective, they can sort of augment that work as well so that it can help you navigate the online world as successfully or more successfully than you are in the offline world.
It's funny, as you're speaking, I'm thinking about that thing that, I'm a mum, and you think the things you always say to the, your kids, or my mum said to me, is you've got to love yourself before you can love someone else or have someone love you. The primary relationship really needs to be with yourself.
I'm wondering if
there's any truth in that, that you need to have kind of know yourself and like yourself if you're going to attract and sustain the right kind of healthy relationship.
I think it definitely starts with knowing yourself. Loving yourself, I don't think a relationship is contingent upon it, because if we think there's lots of people out there who don't really like themselves very much, they're in very good relationships, but they're probably not enjoying them very well. And they're probably not really recognising what a good relationship they have, and they're not getting the benefits of it to see how lovable they are. So absolutely, the relationship with yourself will be the relationship that you seek from other people. So how you treat yourself will be how you will treat other people, and how you will invite other people to treat you. So there are anomalies. There are people who just detest themselves, who have really lovely partners who are really good to them. But very often what we see is people who are a little bit unkind or tough on themselves seek out relationships that replicate that.
And there aren't many spaces to reflect on that, really. Psychotherapy is such a good, non-judgmental, completely open, safe environment to have that conversation with yourself, with somebody there who's there to facilitate that and ask the right questions of you.
And who has built a profession around it because they love it.
And help to make sense of some of the rejections or challenges that may come along the way, and realise that that is not an indictment on you as a person.
Absolutely. Help you process them, make sense of them, and turn them into something valuable.
So really, just to sum this conversation up, which has been absolutely fascinating, in summary, what are the pros and cons of looking for love online? You've mentioned a few things there about recognising that the apps really aren't necessarily representative of long-term relationships in real life. Any kind of quick tips, quick pointers, if somebody's looking at one of those apps now and thinking, oh, shall I press yes?
I think go ahead. I think, as psychotherapists, we have to realise that this is the way it's going. More and more people are meeting each other online, and it really is the future of dating. So go ahead, but go ahead with caution. And, the positive aspect are the reasons why people are on it. It's free, it's always available, and the people who are on it are interested in meeting someone. So it's a really good way to be presented to people. The cons are the manner in which that happens. But if you're aware of them, the tendency to be objectified, the effect it can have on your self-esteem, if you buy into it too much, or if you stay on it too long, if you bear all of those in mind, I think until the apps sort of grow up a little bit and develop beyond that, I think you don't need to be afraid of them. And if it does become tricky, well, there is always psychotherapy.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you. So enjoy your dating. Don't worry.
Yeah.
Just check in with yourself, and that's fantastic advice. Thank you so much, Denise.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That was UKCP's psychotherapist Denise Dunn speaking to Sarah Niblock, the CEO of the UKCP. If, after listening to that, you feel you could benefit from some talking time with a psychotherapist, then go to the Find a Therapist section of the UKCP website and have a look through. The website address is psychotherapy.org.uk, and look for the Find a Therapist tab. We'll also be featuring the subject of finding love online in Psychology's magazine this month, or you can find us online at psychologies.co.uk. We'll be featuring a podcast each month for the next year with some of the UKCP psychotherapists, and remember to like and subscribe to our channel to hear it first, and it helps others to find us too. So join us again next month. Till then, thank you for listening, and take good care of yourselves.